Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. NPR's Renee Montagne is the voice with your morning coffee, a host of NPR's Morning Edition, always there, crack of dawn. But Renee Montagne is also a hell of a reporter. She's just back from Afghanistan, her fifth time out, deep as ever, and right on top of the news headlines of talking with the Taliban. It's happening. Her tape is all over it. Here's Kandahar.
Taliban form of government was so good for us, so we want back our Taliban form of government.
Here's the Panjshir Valley.
We do not want the Taliban to come and cut the noses off our women.
And there's much more. She's with us this hour on Point. NPR's Renee Montagne, back from Afghanistan, ready to talk. You can join the conversation. She's just back. What's your question on women, midwives, the violence, the Taliban, the war? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from the NPR West studios in Culver City, California, is host of NPR's Morning Edition, Renee Montagne. She just spent a month in Afghanistan talking with women, warlords, General David Petraeus, much more, reporting often from under a burqa. Renee, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Tom, thanks for having me.
That was great reporting, and it couldn't have been more timely. You've been there five times. Give us the essentials first, Renee. I don't even know. How does a reporter get to Afghanistan now exactly?
Well, I have to say it's a little bit easier now to get there, and maybe that will be surprising to some than it was when I first went there. When I first went there back in 2002, one had to fly into a neighboring country. It could have been Armenia or Pakistan, and either travel overland, which was difficult and also quite dangerous, or take a UN flight was usually the best and safest way to get in. There were still a lot of UN flights nowadays, but there were at that time, that was one way for a journalist, if you could hop a ride, if there was room on the plane. Nowadays, though, actually, just in this last couple of years, you fly to Dubai, and there's a couple of commercial small flights going over to Kabul. So you can get in pretty easily. It's once you're in, it's getting around that's a little bit more of a trick.
Right. So there's a little bit of a fringe of normalization. But once you're in, and we heard it in your reporting, it's anything but normal in much of Afghanistan right now. You must be watching all these headlines on talks with the Taliban, NATO saying, you know, today that they're facilitating contacts between Taliban members and the highest levels of the Afghan government, granting safe passage to top Taliban leaders to travel to Kabul to meet with Hamid Karzai's government. You talked with people, and there's a lot we want to look at with you today, Renee, but you talked with people specifically about this. It seems like maybe you were anticipating, I don't know, but about the Taliban and whether or not they could live with it. We've got some tape here from Kandahar of people surprisingly ready to live with the Taliban, a couple of young guys. Let's listen, then you'll tell us about them.
Taliban form of government was so good for us, so we want back our Taliban form of government, because in that we got justice and we had peace. Now we don't have peace, so that's why we want back, these guys says. That we want back Taliban's government.
We want back the Taliban government because when we had them, they told you, Renee, we had peace. We'll talk about the setting they were in. But in northern Afghanistan, here's quite a different message, again, from your wonderful tape from this trip. This was Afghan's former director of intelligence, a big story behind him all in itself, talking about the possibility of Taliban coming into the Afghan government.
We do not want the Taliban to come and cut the noses off our women. We do not want the Taliban to destroy what is left of our historical heritage. We do not want them to dominate the scene. So a compromise with the Taliban from a position of weakness and not taking into consideration the massive interest of the Afghan people is what I warn the people. What does Karzai mean when he says, I want peace with Taliban? What does it mean? It is very unclear for our people. We think if we do not rise today, our rights, our very basic rights in a deal with Taliban will be violated fundamentally.
tape from Renee Montaigne's very recent trip to Afghanistan, taking us really in and up close with two different views, one from Kandahar, one from the Panjshir Valley, of talking with the Taliban and what that might mean. Renee, set these two scenes for us and give us these two perspectives. What's behind them?
Well, it's important to know, first of all, that the Panjshir Valley is in the far north mm-hmm. of Afghanistan, and Kandahar is in the far south. And you have there, and this was intentional on my part, you have there the two, if you want to put it, extremes. I mean, the Panjshir Valley is the heart of the armed resistance to the Taliban. It was one area. It's now become an actual province, but at the time mm-hmm. it was a region. It's one area where the Taliban – there are only two places that the Taliban never got in, never actually took over when they ran the government for the 4 years that they ran the government.
Ruled
there.
All the rest of the country, all the rest, but not here.
Exactly. And then, of course, Kandahar, as I think most people know, is the heartland of the Taliban. It's the Kandahar, and more to the point, the farms and the rural areas around Kandahar is from where the Taliban emerged in the first place. So, you know, on the one hand, these two pretty extreme points of view to our ears shouldn't be surprising. On the other, I will say this. Let me talk about those two young guys in Kandahar, Mahmoud Hassan and Mahmoud Chewy.
They were in a coffee shop.
You
were talking with them.
Shop.
It sounded very sort of hip and cool, and I don't know what was going on there.
I tell you the truth, we didn't take time to stop and get a good photograph mm-hmm. because it was the level of movement in Kandahar is so dramatically different than it was the last couple of times I was there.
Level of movement? You mean the level of violence?
The level of violence and mm-hmm. the inability, that is the level of restriction of mm-hmm. your movement, mm-hmm. It's pretty dramatic. So we would hurry out of the car. I was, in fact, as you mentioned, I was wearing a burqa for the first time. Mm-hmm. Our wonderful correspondent, Sarai Sahardi Nelson, had the same experience a few months ago for the first time, really put on a burqa to go into some of these areas. We went to this coffee shop. We were going places and talking to different people, but this coffee shop was the only – it was touted as the only coffee shop in the region, I mean over about six provinces.
Yeah.
You know, they just aren't coffee shops there. People drink tea. They drink mm-hmm. Afghan green tea.
Okay.
But the coffee shop was just what you suspect. It was very shiny and glass, and you know, there were lounges out on a balcony that people could lean back and sip their coffee, and there was you know, pastries and candy.
We got that picture.
Young men.
And this while on the street, you described kind of, you know, violence, unpredictable and all over.
Yes, I think I said Wild West. I was quoting a young mm-hmm. Afghan that we work with who was a translator. He wasn't translating for us down there, but came along with us. And he was shocked. And this is someone who comes from Kabul, not outside, never left mm-hmm. Kabul in his mm-hmm. life. But these guys surprised me a little when the conversation turned to what about the Taliban coming back, because they had the appearance they were prosperous and middle class looking and clean cut.
Right. Going to be a doctor,
although,
one of them said, I think.
One wanted to be a doctor. One mm-hmm. of them, the most talkative, wanted to be a businessman. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the one we were just hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So they have aspirations, and they have aspirations that involve some personal freedom for them, men, young guys. And they also said, you know, they didn't agree with how the women were treated, as in beaten mm-hmm. and hurt. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, seemed to think it was fine for young women to go to school. The thing, though, that we just heard is something that you hear all over Afghanistan, and you do especially hear it in the conflict areas, and these are the more conservative southern and eastern areas. That is, when they talk about security, and justice. They are not talking about the sort of justice we think accurately that the Taliban can hand out. That is executing a young couple that runs off to get married.
Right. They
are talking about the kind of justice that commonly people crave at this moment in time, the ability to go, say, protect your house from being taken by a powerful warlord type. And there are lots of them have all kind of grown up or come back over these last few years.
And they see the Taliban as a defense against that kind of injustice at this point.
Exactly. Well, they'll take anything, and the last thing anyone remembers, and it, you know, is the Taliban. And the Taliban did indeed protect things like property, and they had courts, and there was a certain order. And also, guys like this, by the way, were 5 years old. I mean, these are 22-year-old guys, and the Taliban have been gone for 10 years, or they were 10 years old. So when they say, oh, we remember them well, they are speaking also for their parents. You know, who and they are speaking from Kandahar. Now, when you go north, I'm not talking about the Panjshir. I also went up to Mazar-e-Sharif, another bastion of resistance to the Taliban. You had people who were old enough to remember them, and you had people who might have fought them 10 and 15 years ago say they were so hungry for some sort of order and justice in Mazar-e-Sharif, this northern city in that particular province. They have a very tough governor who they really adore. And he's a warlord, one of the more famous ones. Mm-hmm. But he has tempered his warlord tendencies. And to the degree that there's corruption and graft and whatnot, it's a little Chicago style. It's spread around. It's within limits. Mm-hmm. And I mean Chicago. Excuse me, Chicago. I mean the 1960s. Or New York, you know, the Teapot Dome. I mean, you know, it's something that, you know, could happen in a lot of places. It isn't that extreme sort of warlordism that took over around about the time that the Taliban began to resist it.
That just then took everything and set justice entirely aside. Rene Montaigne, you put meat on the bones of this story in a terrific way. We're going to come back and hear much more, including that voice of the warlord slash governor in the north who says, you know, if the deal is right, he's open to something with the Taliban. That may be getting up on the rails. NPR's Renee Montaigne is just back from a month in Afghanistan, her fifth trip. Sound there, campaign sound from Afghanistan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Afghanistan with NPR's Renee Montaigne, just back from her fifth long reporting trip to the war zone, as NATO confirms it's facilitating Afghan government talks with top levels of the Taliban. A little sound of babies there from a clinic staffed by midwives in the rural north. We'll talk about that with Renee. Spent most of September in Afghanistan, just back, and as always has taken her microphone and her perspective quite wonderfully into many corners of that country. Renee joins us today from NPR West in Culver City, California, but she was out there for a good long stretch, did just tremendous reporting. Renee, lots of feedback here from our website. Nick says, I'm not a religious person as it's defined here in conservative America, but for Renee Montaigne, he says, God bless you. Your reporting and support for Afghan women is one of the bravest acts. We'll talk about that, but I want to stick, if we could, Renee, for just another minute on this issue of talking to the Taliban. It might be the U.S. way out of this conflict. The U.S. presence there is one of the issues in these talks as they get going. You mentioned the governor, warlord in northern Afghanistan. This is Ata Mohammed Nur. You talked with him. Here's a little bit of tape. He's saying, you know, there's talk about reconciliation, and he may not be pro-Taliban, but he's open to talking about it.
If the Taliban are honest with their words and they're trying to reach a real peace in the country and respect our constitution, then we will welcome them. But if they're thinking of endangering what we have gained in the last 9 years, then that will be unacceptable for our people. We are against any peace negotiation which ignores our women's participation in the government and daily life and does not accept the budding democracy.
If they're thinking of anything that endangers what we've gained in 9 years, that's unacceptable, against any peace negotiation which ignores a woman's participation in government and daily life. Renee, we know there's all kinds of ethnic lines that run through this, Pashto and the rest, but just on policy terms, never mind ethnicity for a minute, if that's possible, I mean, can you see any kind of reconciliation wherein, you know, your governor's lines are not going to be crossed here?
I think the governor is more the expert. I will say this. You mentioned at the beginning of the program that I was asking people about talking to the Taliban, and in fact, you know, as this trip shaped up, because we plan these things well in advance, yeah, because of my job, I began to realize that the theme, if there was one, and I've always had something of a theme in these visits, mm-hmm, I sort of realized that what's next? And because it seemed obvious that from everything that I know and that I too read, that there had to be some sort of reconciliation. There has to be some sort of reconciliation. I did an interview with General Petraeus. What he has said in the past, he said it to me very emphatically, that you can't kill your way out of an insurgency. You just can't. And from his point of view, everything was flowing towards some sort of reconciliation. The question was always, for me, going there, what were the parameters of that? What was the time frame? And what did people feel now? And if I came away with one overview, it was that in Afghanistan, mm-hmm, people are very, very nervous about it. The Taliban, to the degree you can believe polls over there, and there's a level that you can, but certainly from what everybody's ever said to me ever, the Taliban are not popular. But there is a realization that there has to be some sort of accommodation, or there will be 10 more years of war. And these people have been living for 30 years with war. So I was a little surprised sometimes at what people said. And I must say, with Atta Mohammed Noor, this governor, I expected him to be tougher. And in fact, he was what you just heard was pretty much what he would have said over and over again. Measured, mm-hmm, wait and see. We're not armed anymore. Although one thing everybody knows over there is there can be militias can rearm.
Yeah. Yeah.
But nobody wants to, and it's not particularly realistic. I mean, this isn't 1990. It's not 1996. It's not 2000. I mean, it's not realistic. I have to say about
not realistic to rearm and have a civil war. Is that what you mean, Renee, or something else?
No, there isn't, because this is in some sense is a civil war, but it's a war. But I mean, it's an insurgency. Actually, I mean, it's a civil war in the sense there are parts of the country that are more Taliban dominated.
Sure.
But it's not realistic. The last time these guys were armed, and this guy, Atta Mohammed Noor, this governor, he was one of the, if there was a list, and there was a list, mm-hmm, these CIA lists of who are the players from way back then. He was a minor player, but definitely on the list. But he was very young at the time. He was in his 20s and early 30s rather than late 30s and 40s. He hadn't been through the whole 80s. He wasn't a powerful mujahideen in the 80s. And so he was at a time when all bets were off. This was like Bosnia if no one was watching, mm-hmm, back in the early 90s, and people weren't watching.
And is he worried about that again, Renee? Is he worried about that returning, that level of universal civil conflict?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't ask him that particularly, mm-hmm, but the mm-hmm universal chaos, mm-hmm, chaos does not seem to be on anyone's mind. I think the issue is really what kind of a deal, what are the circumstances, what's the wiggle room, what is going to have to be sacrificed, and what has been gained and can't be lost. And I mean, I don't have answers to all those questions, but there are like layers and layers and layers of what some sort of reconciliation might mean. And it really makes a difference when and how. Mm-hmm. I think the idea of talk is shocking. It was a little shocking to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But everyone there is familiar with the idea.
You brought us a powerful sense of some of what has been gained that people don't want to lose, particularly when it comes to women, and we'll get to that. But I also want to hear, while we're on this, when you sat down with General David Petraeus in his office in Kabul, talking about this very front, how the military alone won't do it, and here's some of your tape again, where General Petraeus, brought up his experience in the Iraq War.
As I said in Iraq, when I was the commander there, you don't end an industrial strength insurgency by killing or capturing all the bad guys. You have to kill, capture, or turn the bad guys. And that means reintegration and reconciliation. In the case of Iraq, we reconciled with tens of thousands. It was, in Iraq, a major decision. We were actually going to sit down with individuals who had our blood on their hands and talk about reconciliation. Again, You're not going to kill or capture your way. Military action is absolutely necessary, but it is not sufficient.
General David Petraeus talking there just last month with Renee Montagne. She's with us, but in Kabul. Renee, I've got to ask you, what was it like getting to wherever General Petraeus's office is? I mean, we've got headlines here about Afghans linked to the Taliban guarding U.S. bases. What's the security like to get to David Petraeus? And what's it like once you get there?
Well, their location is in the middle of Kabul, the ISAF / NATO headquarters.
It's an International Security Assistance Force.
Security Assistance Force, ISAF, yes. Mm-hmm. They're right in the middle of Kabul. They're in an area that is heavily fortified. So you have to show a lot of ID. And in fact, to get in more smoothly, virtually all the reporters are you get an ISAF badge. Basically, they take your what's that called? I'm just blocking it now.
Identification. Thing. Biometric,
eye scan,
whatever.
Biometric, mm-hmm. Yes, that's it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that hard for me to get in the last time. But this is the place, I will say this, you might remember, and it happened the last time I was in Kabul last year. This, the ISAF, the NATO headquarters, the entrance was bombed last year. In fact, I was just leaving it. I was in a little entourage with Ambassador Eikenberry because the embassy is also on that long street. And on both ends, there's heavy duty, several layers of protection, of gates you have to go mm-hmm. through, and nobody can drive down there. You have to mm-hmm. walk in virtually.
You should hope not.
But it was bombed, and of course, mm-hmm. Sadly, the people who were killed were a dozen Afghans, on the outside. But they've beefed up security since then. You know, you talk about these contractors. In fact, it is contractors. Not Afghan contractors for the most part. These are foreign Western contractors who are guarding. It's a little amazing.
Yeah.
The embassy. I mean, you think the Marines guard the embassies, don't they? Well, not for a long time. They haven't.
Right.
And you pass by these civilians, basically contractors. I didn't do any stories on the contractors who are being hired to protect convoys. And now the convoys are not military convoys for the most part, or not at all. There are the convoys of supplies that keep. They're those oil trucks that you've been seeing going up in flames
in
over in Pakistan.
But this was Senate Armed Services Committee just last week hearing testimony that actually the guards around some of the bases, Afghan guards, are apparently linked to the Taliban. And on that goes. You described in your reporting this, I don't know what, it sounds like kind of an amazing photo or portrait behind Petraeus's desk of Afghans on horseback thundering down behind him upon you if you're sitting there.
Well, yeah, it was actually quite nice. I mean, his wall was filled with photographs of Afghans, and the one was a painting. Yes, and they look like there's a game over there that's originated in northern Afghanistan. Actually, is sort of throughout the Middle East. It's called Bushkazi, and it's played with men on horses, and it's a
the
body
calf.
Of a goat. A goat actually usually that's passed around, and it's a very dangerous game. I mean, you will be trampled and crushed immediately if you slipped off your horse, and all it's a form of. They lean down almost to the ground to pick up this heavy body, and it's sort of like an unprocessed football or something
But speaking, Renee, of a dangerous game then, you're sitting with General David Petraeus. We've all recently, back here in the States, been reading Bob Woodward about how intense and tense the negotiations were about how many U.S. troops would go there. This was between the generals and President Obama, and more than just the generals. How long they would stay. Now there's a begin-to-withdraw date next summer, and the talks with the Taliban. I mean, do you have a sense of where General Petraeus comes down on it? Is he happy to see these talks? Is he afraid that these are a shortcut to an exit that will be premature by his lights? Could you tell?
Oh, yeah. Oh, he has a very clear vision, which he expresses rather well. I had asked him, in fact, the tape we just heard, it was an answer to a question that I had put to him, mm-hmm. which was that President Hamid Karzai had just recently said, and he's rather erratic in his public comments, mm-hmm. President Karzai, mm-hmm. But he had recently said that NATO isn't winning. And I said, how damaging is that to your mission? And that was the answer he gave. I began by saying, not damaging at all. because this is the reality. We can't win. And you've just heard what he said about that. He said, in Iraq, he has the experience of sitting down to talk with people who have blood on their hands, blood of the Americans and his troops on their hands, to sit down with him, talk about reconciliation and work through reconciliation. So his position is very clear. The distinction for him, and this becomes a political point of view on that everybody is welcome to have their own point of view on this, but the distinction for him is that you sit down from a position of strength. And his belief, being General Petraeus, head of NATO, is that they have got to reach a point, the fighting has got to reach a point, and that is the mission, to reach a point where the Taliban are willing to sit down and are themselves sitting down, not from a position of strength. He went on to say, talk about removing troops. I hope – this was him. I'm quoting him. Mm-hmm. We've tried to repeatedly explain, he said, that in July 2011, it's not when – as the president said, President Obama said, we're not going to close the door and turn out the lights, and that if anybody on the Taliban side thinks that, they are set. They will be – surprised.
Sadly mistaken.
They're sadly mistaken. That's his point of view.
Renee, lots of callers for you. Let's go to Sundar in Aiken, South Carolina. Sundar, you're on the air with Renee Montaigne.
Yes, Ms. Montaigne, you have done an excellent job reporting and everything, and I'm an admirer of you. I just ask you one question. Did you ever come across with some person or organization in that region calling the activities of Islamic radical, this Taliban and Al-Qaeda is un-Islamic? Brief question.
Okay, Sundar, thank you. Did you hear it, Renee?
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, people on the street, people would say that. Rula Saleh, who you heard maybe earlier in the program, who was the former intelligence chief, he's up in Panjshir. He quite straightforwardly said, this is not Islam. And in fact, many people say it's not Afghan. I mean, especially things like suicide bombing. It's not only not Islam, it's bound up in not being Afghan. We face our, we fight looking at people. We don't shoot people in the back. We don't kill women and children or innocents of any
description. Ideally as Muslims, he's saying, but not in this case.
As Muslims and as Afghans. Mm-hmm. I've had any number of people say that to me. They don't, I have to be, they don't always bring it up. I think because I'm not often talking to them. In fact, it's almost never that I'm talking to people about Islam. I don't look at, my experience in Afghanistan. I speak mostly to Afghans. I haven't been embedded, although I've traveled once with military, but not in an embedded situation. I'm always out with civilians. I'm always traveling independently. So I don't bring it up a lot, I guess, because it's not on the forefront of my mind whether or not – I'm not thinking of it as an Islamic situation. I'm not thinking that the Taliban are a religious force. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of them as a sociological force, which is within a religion. I guarantee you, if I ask, that's what I would get. I will say one thing: we haven't brought it up, but I went to a madrasa in Kandahar, a new madrasa, and one of the things I would hear, and I heard this back as far as 2004, in Kandahar. Clerics saying very strongly that some of the jihad that is taught in madrasas, which were created during the 80s, funded partly by, American, Saudi Arabia, whatnot. Mm-hmm. I mean, during a time when they were trying to create jihadists against the Soviets, they ended up with hundreds, thousands of madrasas. And in Afghanistan, this is an opinion in Afghanistan, which is, This particular madrasa is teaching computers and language and history and the Quran and, in religion. And they were really, this particular mullah was very careful to say, we are not teaching jihad. We are not teaching violence. That is violent jihad.
Maybe something
that is
new
not Islamic.
Happening. Maybe something new there. And we're glad to hear it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Afghanistan with NPR's Renee Montagne, just back from her fifth long reporting trip. Boys chanting behind us there at the madrasa, the school in Kandahar, she was describing, where they teach reading and writing along with religion. Renee joins us from NPR West in Culver City, California, where she daily hosts Morning Edition. You get her with her coffee, now you get her on Afghanistan. Really great reporting. Jennifer from Red Oak, Iowa, you're on with Renee Montagne. Jennifer.
Hi, Renee and Tom. Thanks for taking my question.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Renee, the people who you talk to out on the street, how do they feel about the United States involvement, maybe past involvement and current involvement?
Good, Renee.
Well, I can tell you, hi, how are you, by the way? Past involvement. Well, you know, intellectuals and professors and politicians tend to know about the think about the past involvement, and that would be in the 80s, and people do remember the United States walking away from Afghanistan, having sort of accomplished the mission, which was to drive out the Soviet Union. That was the perception. But for this last 10 years and for the last 9 years that I've been going there, I will say I've seen a change, but not as dramatic as you might think. In the beginning, back in 2002, 2004, 5, 6, people embraced the, in my experience, and I was going to villages and places like that. I wasn't traveling with military. People embraced the American presence. They were, and the foreign presence generally. I mean, but the Americans were very much the face of, from the beginning, the coalition. They embraced it. They were looking again for security. They had been through a lot. They were had great hopes, and there were a lot of promises, and there were a lot of promises from the international community generally. And there were fewer, you know, there were fewer uniformed people there by a lot, by half, and or less than half. And so the military presence wasn't as far-reaching and broad as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
That has changed to some degree, but I think you should never think that, look, in my, maybe they liked me, but I'm kind of joking about that. But, I mean, people were welcoming of the international community, and I want to say big time, except in small pockets of, you know, places in really in rural areas, maybe, where the Taliban was very, very powerful.
But, of course, there's a tradition of welcoming, right? And then on next to that, you get the damages of war. I mean, Hamid Karzai again and again has had to say, please try not to hit our civilians. You know, they get killed. They're upset.
Well, yeah, I don't know if the tradition of welcoming is really what was at work, though. For the most part, there was great hope. There was a great hope that it was over. I don't know how many times I said 23 years of war. Then it was 24 years of war. And
right.
There was a period where it seemed like there was no war. But yes, and in terms of the civilian casualties, in those early days, I think the foreign press knew more about it and the outsiders knew more about it than Afghans themselves, because there wasn't that much communication there, and not as much as now. But over the last few years, there's been a buildup. Partly because of Hamid Karzai, partly because they all have TV now, partly because there's a lot of internet, more than you know you'd think, partly because they're knowledgeable about the outside world and what's happening inside Afghanistan, and partly because there's been enough of that civilian casualties to have affected more people. You know, again, there's been a buildup.
And it gets complicated as the war goes on. I mean, you've got this incredible piece of tape. Maybe this is just the rumor mill of war, but you've from Mazar-i-Sharif, this fabric seller, Ahmad Shah, you talked to, talking about a rumor that American forces build up, actually not fighting the Taliban, but supporting them. Let's listen.
Unfortunately, they've created lots of problems for us. And the more the soldiers in the northern provinces, the worse the situation will get. And there are even rumors that the Americans or the foreign forces are deliberately trying to destabilize, you know, the north. There are some rumors that they're providing weapons and, you know, other logistics for the Taliban.
Renee, what? Where does that come from?
You know, I'll tell you, there's an even, well, we might consider it a wilder rumor, but there's a certain amount of buy-in to this rumor, and that is that that helicopters, American or NATO helicopters, bring in Taliban from the south and in the dead of night drop them off in the north. And part of that is that the North has, over just a very short period of time, the North, again, to remind everyone, this there was the Northern Alliance. The North is mostly Tajik and Hazara and
stronghold of opposition to the Taliban
stronghold
when it was in
of
power.
Opposition. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, not in this place, Mazar, we've just heard this tape, but in Kunduz, the neighboring province, mm-hmm. taken over. In places I traveled last year, not comfortably, because you get out into the countryside and there's always danger. I mean, there's danger of being kidnapped for money. I mean, there's danger sure. of, you know, it's not just Taliban. But, you know, provinces all around Mazar-e-Sharif, the city, I mean, all around Balkh, that province, mm-hmm. they are now beset with insurgents, and they can't figure it out. And as I think I said in this story, the explanation is if they can't figure it out because they can't figure out why a powerful a military as powerful
there, yeah.
as NATO mm-hmm. could possibly be losing, be letting all this happen, and where were these people coming from because they weren't there before. I mean, there is an answer to that.
What is the answer? Is it just that the Afghan forces and Americans are losing there, or is there something weird?
Well, it's pretty simple. There was the forces up in the north were small, and they were German, and they were nations that were not, you know, in NATO they have these things called caveats, and you can put your troops in a NATO operation out of danger.
Right.
And those
so
areas
there,
were considered very peaceful. They were there. They were seeing themselves, and understandably, they were seeing themselves as doing development work. But yeah, they weren't up until very recently fighting. They have been fighting because they've had to. They've been attacked. But they weren't going out and taking the fight to these incipient insurgency,
and
which
so
is partly
got,
coming from Pakistan, right. partly coming from out across the border, partly coming from within, you know, Pashtun communities, which were small. 15 years ago, they've grown 18-year-olds in the meantime.
Right.
So, you know, it's an insurgency that's grown and people can't figure it out. So they wonder what's going on. Now, their explanation for why the Americans would do this is simply that the Americans want to stay. They want to build bases and they want to stay. I mean, there's a logic to it. But and it's not true, of course. But I mean, so but I was going to say it just quickly in answer mm-hmm. to about the Americans. I think even today, If more development could get done, and if I mean, the fact of the matter is, under Petraeus and before him under McChrystal, civilian deaths were way down. Mm-hmm. But at this point, it's so out of hand that people blame even the Taliban and the insurgents, who are really responsible for about 70% of the civilian deaths now. It's like, well, this is happening because the troops are here, because the foreign troops are here. So I think a lot of Afghans look to Americans and the foreign, as they call the Western troops. They're really worried that they're going to leave and they will be at the mercy of the Taliban. But a lot of more than, say, in recent years, a lot more of them are also exhausted by the whole fight. And at that point, you know, they're looking for a way out.
Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska. Dan, you're on the air with Renee Montaigne.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Renee. My question, Renee, is kind of piggybacking off the last question. In your experience with the tribes and the villages in Afghanistan, do you get a sense that the people there, and I know I'm kind of asking you to think for them, but do you get a sense that they feel subjugated by democracy?
No, I think they feel failed by democracy. I was there in 2004 for the first, you know, when they were the run-up to the first presidential election. I was there for the elections last year. The level of enthusiasm was astonishing. It was beautiful to behold for all the trappings of democracy, the idea that you could try and figure out who you're going to vote for. And look, I was in this province now, northwest of Kabul, we had to go travel deeply and to go to one of President Karzai's few very carefully orchestrated rallies. He didn't really have rallies. He had a kind of a rose garden, or he had a presidential palace, you know, a way of campaigning. And so he had to go deep into this really wild, mountainous empty province. And you'd be driving along and you'd look up, and honest guy, could not figure out how it got up there. You would see political posters, candidates' posters on the slapped onto, glued onto the side of a mountain. And you think, how did they get way up there? I mean, there must have been little footholds something. And these were often local candidates. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Karzai particularly. And people had them on the sides of these walls, you know, the mud compounds. You see the walls. There might be one little wooden, or big, rather, wooden door. Boom, posters all over it. Certainly not for our benefit. I mean, there was nobody coming through that area, but these posters all slapped up. I think what has happened, though, is that the central government and the sort of, well, we've seen it all. This is not news to anybody listening to this. I mean, the powers that be who had control were able to, to work a level of corruption in the actual voting and the aftermath that was painful and astonishing and in its boldness. And so and also I will say one other little quick thing. There's a layer there in the village because it's mostly rural in Afghanistan still. Mm-hmm. There's a layer of the way things got done of, there are elders and, there's a system. And a lot of it is about everybody coming together and agreeing. So there is a kind of a twist to all of this, and that is when you talk about votes being like stolen wholesale, mm-hmm. that certainly happened. It certainly happened. But sometimes in these areas, you're also talking about elders sort of skipping the voting part. Like, we talked to some elders from Paktia, the eastern provinces, and they had come to town. This is last year, and they had come to town to look over the candidates. And by the time we got to them, they had settled on Karzai. Well, that wasn't a surprise because they'd settled on him in, 2004. But they had settled on Karzai. And I said, so what does that mean? And they said, this very openly and mm-hmm. kind of proudly. They said, we're going to go back and we're going to tell everybody to vote for Karzai. So if they went back and told everybody to vote for Karzai, everybody was going to vote for Karzai.
And
these are illiterate people. Right. I mean, these are people who will do that. So it's not a huge step in some of these areas to skip the voting part if it's dangerous. Or, I'm not saying that's good. I'm just saying
that's the way it is.
There were layers of what happened that aren't so obvious from just the reporting about corruption, which was also very real.
Renee, we love the intimacy of your reporting. You got out in the mountains along the northern border, talked with a group there that's been training midwives, and we've got some of your tape from there where you're talking with one who's recounting a harrowing birth that endangered first a baby, then the mother.
I successfully delivered the baby, but I found out that it was a twin. But the problem was that the second baby was in a horizontal position. If she delivered the baby horizontally, she's gonna die. So I put the babies in this room and I turned on the heater and I went to the other room to take care of the mother.
They're a kind of women's empowerment in the far northern mountains of Afghanistan. In the tape brought back by Renee Montaigne. Renee, here's a question from the web from Blair. It says, just wondering if Renee found it hard to talk to the women and get straight answers, including about their feelings of the Taliban returning.
Let's see. I could always talk to women, but there's a little trick over there, and that's that it, especially in very conservative areas, and Badakhshan is as conservative as it gets in the far north, and it is the very farthest northern mm-hmm. province. You can't talk to women always through, especially village women, with a male translator. And I was traveling with a male translator. Partly that's just how it is, and partly it's protective. And so, in Badakhshan, I actually enlisted the unpaid services of an obstetrician, a woman obstetrician. And she helped me out, especially with this one new mother. But with these midwives, these women have been to school for a year and a half. They've left their villages. They have developed a certain level of sophistication, and they're sitting, in a clinic available to all men, women, children. So they had a comfort level with sitting down, talking to me, those who didn't speak English, through a translator. And for the most part, they didn't speak good enough English. That would be minimal English. And so, no, I didn't really have any trouble talking to them.
And if the Taliban came up, could they say we don't want the Taliban back, or could they would they not say that?
The times we spoke to women about the Taliban, they were not up in the north. They have to say that there was a little bit of a deference to, well, I just don't know. I just hope it works out. Honestly, not so different from what Governor, you know, Balk said in Mazar, kind of like, well,
but we've all just seen, Renee, that photograph of the young woman with her nose cut off, who just got the, you know, sort of a surgery to have a prosthesis. But, I mean, Americans are sitting, you hear talk about the talking with the Taliban. You look at all these women in Afghanistan, and a lot of them, I think Americans are saying, can we do this? Is this fair? Can we talk with people who, some of whom, did that?
Well, let me say this. There is another level to that story, and that story was really, the heart of that story was about her husband's family, her running away from her own marriage.
Yeah.
And that story spoke as much about far rural, uneducated women with no hope for getting out from under these millennia-long traditions that are not only the Taliban. The Taliban draw from these traditions. They didn't make them up. And that particular story wasn't even in the South. So though her husband has been said to be Taliban, I've talked to a lot of people in Afghanistan. People read that as a very difficult problem they have to wrestle with as a society, that it can be seen separately from the Taliban as well as a problem from the Taliban.
Renee, the nuance and reporting you bring back is just tremendous. It was great hearing your reports. We're really grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks so much for the big trip, and thanks for being with us today, Renee.
Tom, thank you very much for having me.
Renee Montagne, co-host of NPR's Morning Edition with Steve Inskeep, just back from Afghanistan. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.